Welcome to the ESI Report, brought to you by Krolon Track, the industry leader in data recovery, information management, electronic discovery, and legal technology products and services. Hear the latest information to help lawyers manage electronic evidence accurately and cost-effectively in a changing legal world. You're listening to the Legal Talk Network.
Thanks for tuning in to another edition of the ESI Report. I'm Michelle Lang, host of this legal technology podcast. On today's show, we will explore Judge Shira Shinlin's recent opinion in the case National Day Laborer Organizing Network versus the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. Also, don't miss our Bits and Bytes legal analysis, in which we analyze recent e-discovery amendments to the Florida State Civil Procedure Rules. So, let's get started with all the ESI buzz, the part of the show where we update listeners on the latest e-discovery happenings, catch up with industry experts, and discuss the legal technology news you need to know.
Now, here's the ESI buzz.
One of the attributes that makes for a great e-discovery lawyer is the ability to wade through the digital mire that separates preservation from collection. What search tools will you use? How much control will you allow custodians while implementing your litigation hold? How will you play your hand at the meet and confer? Judge Shira Shinlin, a notable author of the Zubelake opinions from the Southern District of New York, recently issued another groundbreaking case. This one touches on the government's search obligations when facing a request under the Freedom of Information Act, also known as FOIA. Today's e-discovery expert, David Kearney, Director of Technology Services at Cohen & Grigsby, joins me to discuss the importance of the case and what it means for parties caught in the trenches of e-discovery. David authored the July 2012 Law Technology News article, Judge Shinlin Issues Strong Opinion on Custodian Self-Collection. And this article highlights the case we will analyze today. Hi, David. It's Michelle with the ESI Report. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
So let's just get started with the basics. Could you provide a little bit of context for the dispute in this that was underlying this Judge Shinlin opinion, and what are the issues involved?
Sure. The plaintiffs brought action to obtain records under the Freedom of Information or FOIA context from various government agencies, such as the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI, regarding the immigration enforcement program launched in 2008, and it's called Secured Communities. The defendants failed to comply with an agreed-upon production plan. So shortly thereafter, Judge Shinlin ordered production. The defendants then searched hundreds of employees' files to produce tens of thousands of responsive records. So the issue here is whether the defendant's search was adequate in the FOIA context.
So you mentioned that the case involves the Freedom of Information Act and a request under that. It's not really a traditional discovery request for ESI. Could you give a little background on FOIA and the federal government's search obligations?
Sure. And although it's close, in a nutshell, the Freedom of Information Act was signed into law in the mid-60s to prevent government secrecy. So its intent is to facilitate transparency about the government's policies. And when members of the public are disturbed by those policies and they are fighting to end them in some cases, the act calls on the government to diligently and honestly respond to requests, even from people with whom they might disagree. And actually, any person, you or I, can make a FOIA request to obtain information from the federal agencies. And under FOIA, the plaintiffs are entitled to the disclosure and to get as much information as the law permits. So in general, the government in this instance must timely show beyond a material doubt that it had conducted a search reasonably calculated to uncover all the documents that were requested. This is a little bit of a higher standard than the typical, you know, e-discovery search collection case that is really, under the federal rules of civil procedure, searches only really have to be reasonable under Federal Rule 26G. And in my opinion, you know, when I really dug into these to FOIA, it almost seems like these higher standards would might be best even served under the traditional e-discovery umbrella. You know, I think that those higher standards really would push us to make sure that we're doing the right thing and that we're being as transparent as possible. And even if the agencies in this case followed federal rules of civil procedure best practices, I think there would have been a better outcome, and we wouldn't have, we wouldn't be talking about this, because perhaps even if the basics were covered, Judge Shindlin may have not have pursued the path of criticizing and critiquing the search methodology.
So let's talk a little bit about that. What are some of the arguments at hand as to how the ESI was not searched, and what did Judge Shindlin say?
Well, the plaintiffs made two critiques of the searches. First, the argument was that the agencies failed to conduct the searches of the files of custodians who were really likely to be part of this or to have possessed responsive records. Secondly, the plaintiffs argued that the defendants did not establish that the searches that were done were adequate. Additionally, the agency's affidavits. This is something that they prove that they've taken reasonable steps to make sure that they documented their search policies, processes, and so on. And those were not sufficiently detailed. And even the searches that they did that were documented properly still were found to be inadequate.
So a little bit more about those searches. The plaintiffs allege that these were, the agencies provided the custodians with vague search instructions. The custodian used inadequate search terms. Talk a little bit more about what they actually did.
Well, beginning, this is similar to showing insufficient searching and e-discovery. The plaintiffs set out to say, you didn't search particular custodians. It wasn't adequate. We really don't know what you did. And so there are a few examples where the plaintiffs were able to show that certain personnel, and in this case, an FBI director, was directly involved in this secure communities and had to really personally approve certain things that happened. But because, they could show that the director was aware, and this director's files were not searched, they were able to really make the case that, hey, the defendant's searches were insufficient because you did not include this particular individual. The agencies have to establish that they searched all the custodians who are reasonably likely to possess the documents. And, transparency and really, under the FOIA context is extremely important. It's under FOIA and additionally in the e-discovery context, transparency is key. I mean, you can't balance the merits of a case if you really don't look at what certain parties did with regarding searches, and even taking it a step further into the collection, processing, and all the other pieces of the e-discovery process.
You talk a little bit about the fact that the government argued that custodians should be trusted to run effective searches for responsive information to the FOIA request on their own. Is this, as simple as a Google search? And what did Judge Shindlin have to say about the self-collection argument?
Judge Shindlin stated, it's very much different than a Google search. If you can imagine giving a custodian the responsibilities to search their records with a search that might contain up to 50-plus terms, it would be very difficult to argue that they can, in fact, handle that responsibility. There are search architects or search specialists out there that can help you with your searching. And understanding the technology and how the searches apply across the search set or the documents and files that are going to be searched. And something else that must be considered, if custodians are given the responsibility, they may bring a bias when they're searching their records. Idols, under certain circumstances, they don't understand the gravity of the duty to preserve. And they actually might hit delete if they come across something that might be responsive, but it might also be incriminating in the same sense. So you can't necessarily put all of your faith in the custodians to collect their data. You know, maybe, just maybe, under the simplest of conditions, a self-collection can be done and might pass muster with detailed documentation and a level of supervision. But there was nothing simple about this case. There were many departments being searched, many custodians being searched, and now that this is really under the FOIA umbrella, it's really a complex case. You know, it's a balancing act. It's a balancing act as far as making sure you don't preserve everything, but at the same time, you need to be able to capture and have documented what you captured and why.
So what does this case suggest we should do effectively with regards to searching in e-discovery generally outside of a FOIA case?
Transparency is key. I mean, it's really, I can't overemphasize being transparent and having documentation. It's not a matter of if you are going to be questioned on how you did certain things or conducted your searches or collections and so on. It's really when. So it's going to be very important to make sure that you are transparent and being able to provide the necessary documentation and be able to explain your processes when you are, in fact, questioned.
So what about just general closing remarks for anyone listening out there with regards to either law firm lawyers or corporate counsel or IT folks, either in a law firm or a corporation? All of these different roles and individuals are dealing with the weighty issues of preservation and collection. Any tips or advice?
Well, just being able to follow e-discovery best practices. Not necessarily under the FOIA context or under the general e-discovery process, but you know, we seem to be heading in the right direction as far as standards and being able to define sort of the one right way, so to speak, to do things. I think that right now law firms, you know, we're still in a state of, you know, being unsure about e-discovery. I mean, there's a lot of cost to it. There's a lot of technology involved. So once all of these pieces start to come together, I really think that we'll be able to have a true standard. You know, we're all sort of still guessing right now as to, you know, how we do certain things and under what conditions and why. And secondly, you know, I keep mentioning transparency. Transparency is key, and it kind of reminds me of when I was in grade school, and the math teachers always said, show your work. Show me your logic. Show me how you got to the answer that you did. And that's really, under the FOIA context, extremely important. So being able to show your work, and that doesn't mean necessarily, even though the answer is wrong, if you can show your logic and how you got to point B, that is really going to help you when you're questioned on your processes and protocols that you follow.
I think you've hit the nail right on the head, David. You know, whether it's technology-assisted review or Boolean operators or just even what the search terms are, it's still very much a moving target today. And I think the bottom line is that you don't want to dig your client into a hole by hiding the ball or not, you know, meeting in good faith with regards to showing what you're doing. David Kearney, thanks so much for a great interview on the topic of this recent case and opinion by Judge Shindlin.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for talking with me today.
That was David Kearney, Director of Technology Services at Cohen & Grigsby. For more ESI news and information, sign up for the eDiscovery Rediscovered newsletter by Kroll OnTrack, available in the resource library at KrollOnTrack.com.
Is your organization considering bringing e-discovery in-house? Traditional e-discovery software solutions typically require a sizable upfront investment, installation time, and IT training. The Verve SaaS platform, powered by Kroll OnTrack, can be up and running quickly at a predictable, transparent cost. Find out what Verve DIY eDiscovery can do for you. Visit www.crawlontrack.com/Verve for more details. Now back to this edition of the ESI Report for today's Bits and Bytes legal analysis.
Today on the Bits and Bytes segment, we are going to take a look at new e-discovery amendments taking effect in Florida. Increasingly, states and nations are revisiting procedural rules to accommodate the proliferation of electronically stored information in business and everyday life. Elliot Westman of Kroll on Track is here to help me address Florida's new state civil procedure rules and what the updated provisions mean for lawyers coping with e-discovery in the Sunshine State. Elliot, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Michelle.
Before we dig into the provisions, let's touch base on the basics. When did the changes go into effect, and what's the big idea behind the state amendment rule changes in Florida?
Well, the amended rules take effect on September 1st this year, and they were adopted on July 5th. So the new provisions affect 7 of Florida's civil procedure rules, and they look a lot like the 2006 federal rules amendments. And hopefully, the amendments will bridge the gap between Florida state courts and the expansive body of federal e-discovery cases, giving parties and courts a little more guidance and precedence to stand on.
So this sounds like Florida is adopting what some of the other states have done with regards to the 2006 federal ESI amendments. Let's bore down a little bit more on really some of the important issues. First off, are there any landmines in the new rule that would take a totally new approach to the 2006 principles that that we're so familiar with?
Well, parties used to practicing under the federal rules should be pretty much in the clear. However, there are some minor differences that we should address. Unlike the federal rules, the amended Florida rules do not impose a mandatory meet and confer requirement. Under Florida Rule 1.2, quote, the court may order, or a party by serving a notice may convene, a case management conference, end quote. So, if a case management conference is held, parties should be prepared to address preservation issues, Form NF production, and requests for phased discovery. Also, when a case is deemed complex, parties must meet additional obligations. So, for one, parties have a mandatory case management conference obligation. Additionally, when parties confer and prepare a joint statement in a complex case, the statement must address the possibility of obtaining an ESI preservation agreement. It also must touch on form of production and whether the discovery should be phased or limited to certain custodians or timeframes. So really, the bottom line is that as in many other jurisdictions that have adopted e-discovery rules, early discussion about ESI is encouraged. And more often than not, early discourse is in any party's best interest.
So let me see if I got this right. If it's a straightforward case, no mandatory meet and confer requirement, but if it's deemed complex pursuant to the rules, then there are these additional obligations, one of which is this meet and confer, as the state Florida state rules call it, a case management conference. Interesting.
Right. It's one of those multi-track things that we're seeing in other jurisdictions. So it's going to be a bifurcated process where there's either going to be a complex litigation, certain obligations, or a non-complex litigation, and then less heightened regulations.
Any other key differences with regards to the new Florida state civil procedure rules?
Well, another important rule is Florida Rule 1.380, Subdivision E. And this rule looks exactly like Federal Rule 37E. It's a sanctioned safe harbor. Quote, absent exceptional circumstances, a court may not impose sanctions under these rules on a party for failing to provide electronically stored information lost as a result of the routine, good faith operation of an electronic information system.
So this sounds pretty familiar. What's the catch?
Well, the provision stands alone. So there's no codified trigger point, and there's no tie-in sanctions rule. As other commentators have noted, the provision should encourage parties to get familiar with spoliation case law under the federal rules. So to be on the safe side, assume preservation kicks in when litigation becomes reasonably anticipated. And then to be extra cautious, entertain the idea that negligence can trigger spoliation sanctions in some federal courts. We'll see how Florida courts cope with the e-discovery spoliation under their new rules, but for now, it's better safe than sorry.
All right. So do the Florida rules touch on any ways that parties can limit burdensome e-discovery?
Yes, they do. The rules contemplate two ways in which e-discovery may be limited, much like the federal rules. So first is the good cause test at Florida Rule 1.280D1, which allows a producing party to show that the information sought is not reasonably accessible because of an undue burden. Once this showing is made, the requesting party has an opportunity to show good cause for discovering the not reasonably accessible information anyways. The court may then order production, but may also add limitations or some stipulations. For example, a court could order a producing party to produce from inaccessible backup tapes, provided, however, that the requesting party pays for a portion of the costs associated with the production.
So this sounds familiar too. It sounds like cost shifting under the federal rules.
Yep, exactly.
So what's the other ways that e-discovery can be limited under the new Florida State Civil Procedure rules?
The other way e-discovery may be limited is under 1.280D2, which looks a lot like the proportionality test at Federal Rules 26B2B and C. Courts, quote, must limit the frequency or extent of discovery, end quote, if the burden or expense of discovery outweighs its likely benefit, considering factors like the amount in controversy, for example. So, producing parties have tools to let the court know that e-discovery may get out of hand. Hopefully, Florida courts will use their e-discovery case management powers to keep fishing expeditions in check.
Any other new provisions that you want our listeners to know about?
The Florida rules also speak to format of production in a way very similar to Federal Rule 34. The requesting party may specify a format. And then the producing party can come back, and they have a couple different options depending on the requesting party's first move. So the producing party can come back and either object and state the form it intends to use, or it can go ahead, comply, and produce in the requested form. If the requesting party does not specify the form of production, then the producing party has some options. They can produce in a form or forms in which the information is ordinarily maintained, or they can produce the information in a reasonably usable form or forms.
Again, this sounds fairly similar to what we're familiar with in the federal courts with regards to format of production. I'm assuming that federal case law will be instructive here for state practitioners in Florida?
Absolutely. Federal case law prohibits parties from detracting content under the guise of reasonably usable form. So if you're the producing party, you're not going to want to print out and scan documents back in as a less useful format. And again, don't convert documents into images to get rid of metadata. As a final note, if you want to pull up the rules online, a quick Google search for Florida e-discovery amendments 2012 should get you there. And you can also review changes to Rule 1.340, which is interrogatories to parties, and Rule 1.410, subpoenas, which we didn't cover today. As a final mention, for a comprehensive state-by-state rule list, be sure to check out www.crowlontrack.com. Click on the resource library and then rules and statutes.
Thanks, Elliot, for that comprehensive look at the new Florida State Civil Procedure rules and keeping us informed on, as always, what's going on with regards to e-discovery rules across the country.
My pleasure, Michelle.
Hey, listeners, did you know Kroll on Track offers a free online library of thought-leading ESI legal resources? If you're looking for upcoming legal technologies programs or recent ESI case law and rules, make sure you visit krolontrack.com/resources. Well, it looks like we've come to the end of another great show. I'd like to give special thanks to today's guests, David Kearney at Cohen & Grigsby and Elliot Westman from Kroll on Track. Join us next time as we continue discussing cutting-edge ESI issues. Until then, I'm Michelle Lang, reminding you that when you think ESI, think Kroll on Track.
The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by, Legal Talk Network, its officers, directors, employees, agents, representatives, shareholders, and subsidiaries. None of the content should be considered legal advice. As always, consult a lawyer. Thanks for listening to the ESI Report here on Legal Talk Network. Visit KrolonTrack.com to learn more about the e-discovery, computer forensic, data recovery, and consulting services and solutions offered by KrolonTrack today.